This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
We do it at a kind of instinctual level.
So in Cooked, you say that cooking is literally baked into our biology. What do you mean by that?
Well, we are obligate cooks at this point. We have evolved. It was probably 2 million years ago that we seized control of fire and learned how to transform food by means of fire. When we did that, we gave ourselves an enormous evolutionary edge over some other species, because when you cook food, you get more energy from it, and you don't have to use as much energy to process it in your body. You don't need digestion. It's a very energy intense process, and cooked food is easier to digest. It's also safer and often detoxified in the case of tubers and crops like that. And you don't have to chew it as much, which saves you an awful lot of energy and time. And when we discovered cooking, it was a watershed event in our own development. This is when, according to the cooking hypothesis, which I discuss in the book, this is when the human brain undergoes its kind of quantum expansion in size and complexity. And at the same time, when the human gut, or the ape gut we had, shrinks, because we don't need as much, we don't need as many metabolic resources to digest food once we've started cooking it. So, but at this point, you can't turn back. Our whole bodies and lifestyles are organized around the access to cooked food. And yeah, people can live on raw food, and there are people who live on exclusively raw foods, but two things about them are worth noting. One is they're really dependent on the Vitamix to process their food. Otherwise, they would be spending half their waking hours in the act of chewing, like many apes our size do. And also the fact that people on a complete raw diet, according to the the science I've read, don't do very well. About half the women stop menstruating, suggesting that they're not getting all the energy they need from a raw diet. So, you know, there's nothing wrong with raw food or some raw food, but I think an exclusively raw food diet, there's some good arguments against it.
And you quote Claude Levi-Strauss about how human culture begins with cooking, according to him. And a lot of the French people in the book seem to believe that human culture begins with cooking.
Well, you know, Levi-Strauss, that wasn't his theory. He just kept noticing as he looked at different groups and tribes around the world that many of them used the same metaphor, that nature was raw and culture was cooked. And it was in the transformation of one into the other that civilization really begins. And so this was just a kind of, universal metaphor, but it turns out to have a lot of truth behind it. And of course, there have been other people in our history who've said that we are the cooking animal, and it's about as good a way to draw a line between us and other species as there is. Although I did encounter some exceptions to it. So, for example, if you include fermentation, as I do, as one of the principal transformations that we call cooking, which is to say cooking with the use of microbes and without the use of any heat whatsoever, except the heat generated by the microbes. If you call that cooking, then you find that there are animals who ferment their food before they eat it. When squirrels bury acorns, for example, they're not just hiding them. They're allowing them to ferment, and the microbes in the soil are beginning to break down the polymers and make accessible the minerals. Basically, seeds are kind of locked up tight by the plant until various enzymes are released. And so squirrels arguably cook their acorns, and any animal that buries its food is probably doing some cooking. Even, birds that keep seed in their craw, you can argue either way. It's either digestion or cooking. Of course, it's happening inside their bodies. But that souring of seeds is a proto-form of cooking.
In case you just tuned in, you're listening to Health Watch, and we're talking today with Michael Pollan about his new book, Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. Michael, the two transformations that were most magical to me were that of air and of earth, the last two chapters in Cooked. And you said it wasn't that surprising that after you researched these two elements, that wine and bread would be part of the sacrament in Catholicism. And you also noted that making bread was the thing that you were most proud of doing of the various things you explored. What is the magic of the element of air and making bread?
Air is where I talk about bread, because bread is a good loaf of bread is about 80% air, and the challenge of baking is how do you get air into bread, and why you want to do that is complicated, but it has to do with flavor and digestibility and scent, basically. And we like airy foods because it conducts delicious molecules to the back of our mouths and from there up to our nasal passages where we can taste them. We have a secondary sense of taste called retronasal olfaction, which deals with food once we've eaten it rather than before we've eaten it, which is orthonasal olfaction. But bread is, you know, you can see why it was regarded as so miraculous and why Christ used it to as a demonstration of his divine powers. I mean, you know, it does appear as if you're multiplying the amount of food you have through this transformation, because it gets bigger before your eyes. And it is an incredibly satisfying thing to learn how to make, because you end up, you know, taking this kind of white mud called dough and ending up with this beautiful, fragrant, risen, large form, something that just didn't exist, you know, before. I mean, it really does seem, you know, de novo. I mean, it just out of pure nothing, you have this this great thing that you've created, which, by the way, happens to be wonderfully tasty. People's feelings about gluten notwithstanding. But
could you talk more about gluten? You have a section, Gluten and the Triumph of Wheat, and then you also do a little bit of a meditation on why there might be a rising tide of gluten problems.
Yeah, well, gluten is a very interesting substance. It's actually two proteins that come together when wet in a kind of mesh, glutenin and gliadin. And when they come together, one of them is extensible or stretchy, and the other one is kind of rubbery and pulls back. And together, they are what allows bread or dough to hold air in a way very few other grains allow it to do. They basically form those little balloons. And so when gas is produced inside the dough during the fermentation, they can hold it. They can stretch and hold it. And you know, other grasses are just as nutritious or arguably more nutritious. People ate barley before the invention of bread and were quite content with that. But barley could not rise. You couldn't leaven barley very well. And so it is when the powers of gluten are discovered, which happens with the first loaf of bread, which probably was baked in ancient Egypt about 6,000 years ago, that wheat begins to take over from all the other grasses until today, when it's, you know, one of the most widely, if not the most widely planted crop, 550 million acres devoted to wheat. And the reason is because wheat has gluten. So gluten was the wheat plant's ticket to world domination. And we, as a result, have a lot of gluten in our diet. Is it a problem? Well, for some people it is. There is celiac disease, which is it's not exactly an allergy, but a strong reaction to gluten that leaves people who eat it very, very ill and unable to absorb nutrients and leads to a failure to thrive in children who have it. And then there's a more, somewhat more, and that represents 1 or 2% of the population. And then there's a somewhat more vague category of gluten intolerance. And these are people who don't feel well, their digestion gets screwed up when they eat gluten. And the numbers of those people seem to be growing at rates that are kind of eye-popping and make you wonder how things could have changed that fast. Some people think it's because we're eating more gluten, and we certainly have bred wheat to have as much gluten as possible. However, for most of Western history, people ate a lot more bread than we do, about 50% in the diet of someone in the West, in Europe, for most of the last millennium. So they've been getting more gluten than we were. So the question is then why this recent problem? And there's a couple theories that I explore, none of them exclusive or necessarily the answer. One is that a lot of people think they have gluten intolerance and don't, and that the power of suggestion is playing a role, and that if your friend tells you they got off gluten and they feel great and they're sleeping better, if you do it, you're going to feel better yourself too. It's just kind of a placebo effect. So possibly that explains some of it. Certainly the incidence of gluten intolerance it's hard to imagine it's rising as fast as the market segment of gluten-free products is rising. But, you know, I do run into people for whom this is a real phenomenon, and it could be explained as part of a more general disorder of our immune systems. Our immune systems are disordered in many ways. We have an enormous increase in autoimmune diseases of all kinds, allergy, eczema, asthma. Our immune systems are mistaking friends and foes very often and attacking things that are not real threats. And gluten, that big pair of molecules, may be some such thing, that because of our disordered immune systems, our bodies are going crazy and attacking. Another possible explanation, and that may have to do with the fact that our gut microbiome is struggling under the pressure of the Western diet, and a lot of people have their epithelial layer, the inner skin, the lining of the intestines, may be a little more permeable than it should be, allowing big molecules, possibly like gluten, to escape and cause reactions. Another theory, though, is that we're using gluten in a different way, which is to say we are fermenting bread no longer slowly and with a sourdough culture, but very quickly with instant yeast, a kind of monoculture of Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which is the yeast that raises bread and also makes alcohol, makes beer. There is some interesting research out of Italy suggesting that if bread is given a proper long sourdough fermentation, such as all bread was until not too long ago, that fermentation breaks down the gluten and destroys certain peptides on the molecules that may contribute to celiac disease, and that people who have properly fermented breads do not struggle with either celiac or gluten intolerance the way people on instant rise breads struggle. So, as I said, you know, it could be some combination of all these factors. There's a lot going on, and we don't really know the answer for sure. But it's all very intriguing, and I kind of lay it out in the book without, you know, taking sides and saying this is clearly what's going on, because we just don't know.
Well, let's use that as a place to jump further into fermentation, the last chapter on Earth, which seems to me the chapter of the most mystery and wonder. And you have a saying that goes against the idea of terroir, the idea that place is informing the food that comes from the French wine tradition, that everything is everywhere. And you have a story about a cheese-making nun and her wooden paddle that sort of demonstrates this idea of everything is everywhere. Could you share that with our listeners?
Yeah, you know, there's always been this question that where do these microbes that create, say, San Francisco sourdough bread or the taste of a particular cheese come from? And one of the kind of mysteries of fermentation is that these microbes, the necessary microbes, just kind of show up if you give them the right conditions, and no one knows quite where they come from. So when we first discovered the lactobacillus responsible for sourdough bread in San Francisco, we named it San Franciscensis, and assumed that we'd found it here and it must be a local microbe. But then it started showing up all over the place, and they found it in Belgium and Moscow, and it seems to be everywhere you make sourdough bread and just about nowhere else. So one theory of microbiology is if you create the right conditions, there is microbes are everywhere. They're in the air, they're on our bodies, they're in the soil, that they will respond and take off once they have conditions to their liking. But that doesn't necessarily contradict the idea that there might be a microbial terroir, that even the species, although the species of microbes might be consistent across borders, there are a significant amount of variation locally. And so Sister Noella, the cheese-making microbiologist nun that I spent some time with, I mean, she believes that even though Geotrichum, which is a very important microbe in cheese making, is just about everywhere and on all cheeses, the differences in strain are significant enough to produce slightly different flavors in different places. But you know, she made she makes a version of Saint Nectaire, which is a traditional French cheese from the Auvergne, and she used the traditional barrel and the traditional paddle and the traditional recipe. And lo and behold, she ended up with the same bugs that they find in Saint-Nectaire in France. And that's quite mysterious how that could happen. But she's a fascinating character. I learned so much from her because she sees cheese in both its spiritual and microbiological dimensions at the same time. And she had a real conflict because she was making cheese in a barrel, which is kind of, you know, outrageous in this day and age of stainless steel. And but she was convinced that the barrel was safer than stainless steel, even though you can't sanitize it. It's almost impossible to sterilize a wooden barrel because there's so many nooks and crannies for bacteria to hide out in. So the health department wanted to close her down, and she created a demonstration for them, though, that persuaded them to leave her alone. And what she did was quite remarkable. She took some raw milk cheese from the abbey's, her abbey is in Bethlehem, Connecticut, and she added, you know, to put like 5 or 10 gallons in a stainless steel vat and put 5 or 10 gallons in her traditional cheese-making barrel, and she deliberately inoculated them both with E. coli. And something very interesting happened. After 3 or 4 hours, the stainless steel vat of milk was had seen such a tremendous bloom of E. coli that it was completely toxic. Meanwhile, the wooden barrel batch of milk had vanishingly small amounts of E. coli. And what had happened is the lactobacillus that live in the barrel, in this white scum that's always there, they had started proliferating as soon as they encountered milk, which is one of their favorite foods, lactose for the lactic acid eating, for the, you know, lactose eating bacillus, and they transfer that lactose, which is a sugar, into lactic acid, acidifying the milk, and that acid level killed off the E. coli. So you see, those traditional French cheesemakers were practicing a kind of folk microbiology before we even knew what that word was.
That's a perfect segue into your article in the New York Times Magazine about germs and also post-Pasteurians. What are post-Pasteurians and what are they onto that that the Sister Noella was probably onto as well?
Well, you know, we've been engaged in a all-out war against bacteria since Pasteur, since he showed us that microbes were the cause of disease, and they are the cause of disease. But as even he understood, most microbes were not the cause of disease. Most of them were absolutely harmless, and in some cases were actually very beneficial. But as often happens in modern society, the subtleties of the message did not survive, and basically we treated bacteria as a threat, all of it. And we live in an age of hygienic food, and in an age where we use antimicrobials in everyday life. You know, we wash our lettuce in chlorine, and we use hand sanitizers, and we eat a lot, we ingest a lot of antimicrobial substances with our food. We give antibiotics to our meat animals, and with the result that the Western gut microbiota, which is to say the community of bacteria that live in your large intestine and are, we're learning, essential to your health and well-being, are struggling with this onslaught. And the post-Pasteurians, this is a term that I think was coined by an MIT anthropologist, are people who are trying to renegotiate the terms of our relationship with the microcosmos with bacteria and fungi, on the understanding that most of them are healthy and that we are we make a tremendous mistake by trying to kill them all, and that we're paying for it with our disordered immune system, as we were talking about earlier, and a sick gut, which is leading, you know, perhaps to very high rates of autoimmune disease and possibly chronic diseases as well. So I met this fascinating culture of fermentos, people who are avid about fermentation. They're remarkably relaxed about hygiene. They kind of turned me on to this world of the fermentation within your body, because that's what's happening in your large intestine. The fiber and other plant parts and other foods, too, that are not digested in the upper GI end up there and are fermented. And that fermentation turns out to be very important to our health, because it the byproduct of it is many valuable nutrients, like some vitamin Bs and some vitamin K, but also short-chain fatty acids that nourish the gut lining itself directly. And that one of the hallmarks of the Western diet is that it consists of readily absorbable sugars and fats, most of which never make it to the large intestine. And I talk to scientists who really believe we're starving the large intestine of what it needs to be healthy, because we eat so little fiber in our diet. Most processed food has little or no fiber. And so we've designed a diet that's very appealing to us, but offers very little to the microbes. And, you know, we're only 10% human. The rest is microbes. So we have to figure out a way to feed them, too, if we're going to be healthy. And that is, it's a whole different way than I had ever thought of looking at the crisis of the industrialized diet. But it explains a lot, that essentially we're not feeding the fermentation within.
We had the science writer Mary Roach on about her new book, Gulp, and she was arguing in there that our squeamishness and our revulsion around the colon and its contents was actually retarding a lot of legitimate research. For instance, anal cancer didn't have a association advocating for it until a couple years ago, and fecal transplantation is something in its infancy now. Do you think there's something to that around?
I haven't read Mary's book yet, but I'm sure she's right. It's also, you know, to think of those 2 pounds of bacteria living in your colon as an organ, which is essentially what it is and how it functions, takes quite a leap, because it doesn't look like much, and it doesn't have a structure that's perceptible to us, and it disgusts us too. So all these things make it very hard for us to see it correctly, and I'm sure it has slowed research. But now, of course, we have these powerful new tools, this batch sequencing of DNA, which allows us to take a sample of any kind of biomass, whether it's feces or seawater or soil, and batch sequence all the DNA in it, and then tease it apart to figure out what species are there. Suddenly we have a powerful new light to look into this wilderness. And what we're finding is extraordinary. It's a very exciting time in the science of the gut and the science of the microbiome. And I think over the next 5 years, some of the most important discoveries about human health will come out of that research.
Well, let's broaden our focus for a minute and talk about the larger ways you talk about cooking and transformation. Sandra Katz, who figures prominently in the fermentation chapter, mm-hmm. He argues for fermentation as a form of cultural revival. And I believe you do the same for cooking as a whole, as a form of cultural and economic revival. Can you tell us a little bit about what you mean?
Well, you know, fermented foods are very interesting. They're different than other foods. First of all, they're acquired tastes. They're not the kinds of flavors that, you know, any baby gravitates toward. They don't have the simple satisfactions of sweetness or the way ice cream does or chocolate or something like that, even though chocolate is fermented. But they're culturally very specific tastes. And so one of the interesting things you find is that fermented foods are culturally defining. And so many cultures have a ferment that they feel is them, you know, in the way that the Koreans think kimchi is their defining food, or the Chinese love stinky tofu, which is essentially, you know, blocks of tofu soaked in rotten vegetables. And we like cheese. That's a very important food to us. And it's very interesting to see how across cultures these foods often are regarded as disgusting by other people. So they're a way of kind of knitting us together. You know, we're the people who like cheese. And they're the people who like stinky tofu. I mean, we're as grossed out by stinky tofu as the Chinese are grossed out by cheese. And so that, you know, you've got two cultures at work here. You have the microbial culture that creates these foods, which, of course, is preserved by people making them generation after generation or batch after batch. And then you've got the, so you have the microbial culture, and then you have the human culture. And these two things feed off each other, literally, and are passed down from generation to generation, which, of course, is exactly what culture is. So it's a fascinating area to explore, and at so many levels. At the cultural level, you know, I went to a kimchi museum in Seoul, one of six in the country, and here were all these kindergartners trooping through on field trips, and they all had their identical yellow backpacks, and they looked kind of bored, frankly. And I asked and they're looking at dioramas of women making kimchi and collections of ancient urns and piles of spice. And I asked the docent, I said, why do you bring little children to a kimchi museum? And she said with a completely straight face, children are not born liking kimchi, which is to say they must be taught. And the reason they must be taught is that it's part of learning to be Korean. You know, you learn the national anthem and you learn to like kimchi. So fermented foods perform many, many functions for a society. And, of course, that wasn't the original function. The original function was simply preservation. Before you had refrigeration, fermentation was how you protected food because the lactic acids in it kept them from rotting and kept them safe. Fermented vegetables are one of the safest things you can eat. Fermented cheese is a little more complicated.
One of the other areas on a sociological level that I think Cooked is asking for a reexamination of and a possible transformation of is gender roles. And you talk about how the fast food industry really exploited the women's movement in the 70s to get a toehold in a specific way in our lives. And really it seems like if we're going to go back to cooking as a part of both as a craft and as a functional part of our daily living, it's going to require some sort of reexamination of who's doing the cooking.
Without question. And we're not going to go back. We can only go forward. Going back to a world where women were cooking most of the meals is just not going to happen and shouldn't happen. And the future of cooking, if there is a future of cooking, is going to be getting men and women and children, very important, into the kitchen. And for reasons of fairness is one reason, but also because it has so many rewards to offer men and children. I think, you know, one of the problems with cooking, and one of the reasons that many people turned against it, is that it was isolating. You know, in the nuclear family, women were cooking alone in very quiet suburban subdivisions after men went off to work and kids went off to school. And that's not that much fun, necessarily. Some people like cooking alone, but many people prefer cooking with other people. It's a great time for conversation. And if you look historically, it is where a great deal of conversation took place, is around the millstone and over the, you know, around the community oven and around the chopping block. And so I think we need to restore that social dimension to cooking. And one of the ways to do that is obviously to cook with friends and get, you know, men into the kitchen. I think we have an opportunity to do that. I think that the stereotype of cooking as women's work is loosening its hold. Looking at kids today, my own son, he really does not have that stereotype because he's watched men cook quite a bit in his own life, and he's also watched a lot of cooking shows on TV where you see all these macho guys, and it's a completely prestigious profession these days to be a cook. So I think we have an opportunity to build a non-sexist culture of home cooking, and nothing would do more for our health and the happiness of our families if we could establish that culture.
Well, Michael, it was a pleasure having you on HealthWatch today, and I was hoping we could just end the program with your thoughts on how cooking transforms us from consumers to producers and the stepping stone that is for larger changes in the world.
Sure. Well, you know, I'll tell you a little secret about this book. It's only partly about food. It fundamentally is about how we organize our lives and to what extent are we going to be consumers or producers. Our society, consumer capitalism, is organized in such a way that we're really encouraged to just do one thing, the one thing we do well that we, you know, make a living at. If you're a doctor, that's what you do. Or if you're a writer, that's what you do. And you're supposed to take your money from that work, and everything else, all your other needs and desires are turned into occasions for consumption. I think that that's a kind of impoverished way to live. I think that, I don't know about you, but my identity as a consumer is not the identity I'm proudest of. I'm more proud when I produce, when I make things. And we normally assume that that means work, not leisure. But actually, producing as part of your leisure is an incredibly satisfying thing to do. You know, whether you're growing a little of your own food in a garden or cooking it or, you know, fixing your car or sewing your clothes or whatever it is, these DIY pursuits are satisfying because they make us feel, hey, there's some I can provide for myself. I'm competent. I'm self-reliant. Not completely, but partly. And that's a very empowering thing. I think one of the reasons we have so much trouble imagining living in a different way, using less fossil fuel, say, you know, adapting to a world of climate change, is because we are so dependent on so many others for everything we need. And to the extent that we can take back control of production and take care of ourselves a little bit more and not outsource everything to corporations, I think we begin to entertain the possibility of change, that we can imagine living in a different way because we've already reorganized our own lives. So I think there's something very empowering about getting into the kitchen. And the beauty of cooking as opposed to all the other things you might do is you already have the means of production. It's called your kitchen. We already have the factory we need to begin this kind of production. We don't have to go buy the tools. We don't have to create the place, the workshop. So it's a really good place to start. And that's one of the reasons I wrote this book, because I think there's a lot more at stake than our diet in the way we're organizing our lives.
And you do a really great job, Michael, of evoking a sense of fun and curiosity, but also that it can involve failure and practice and patience and still be something that's explorative.
Yeah, you know, it's not about being masterful. It's about trying it and failing, and there's nothing wrong with failing. And I certainly made some bad batches of kimchi, and I made a batch of beer that smelled like Band-Aids. So, you know, part of it is we're intimidated that we set a really high bar. But you do what you can, and you get better at it the more you practice. And so learning how to be comfortable with failure in the kitchen is also a very important lesson that it teaches.
Well, I started out on my journey of braising inspired by Cooked already.
Oh, that's wonderful, David. I'm so happy to hear that.
Well, thanks for being on HealthWatch today, Michael.
Oh, thank you very much. It was great to be here.
We were talking today with Michael Pollan, the author of Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. You've been listening to HealthWatch on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host.
Good morning, Pee-wee.
Good morning, Mr. Breakfast.
Start your morning right and come celebrate 45 years with the Fruits, Nuts, and Flakes at the first ever Breakfast with the Boo, Saturday, June 1st, 9 a.m. to noon. There'll be live music, pancake flipping, bluegrass picking, and so much more. That's Saturday, June 1st, 9 a.m. to noon at the Matt Dishman Community Center, 77 Northeast Knott Street. More information can be found at kbu.fm.
Bisquick, 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 pancake, 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 waffle. Bisquick, bisquick.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Passport to Empowerment, a benefit party to raise money for green empowerment. Guests will raise funds for renewable energy and water projects in remote villages globally. Passport to Empowerment will bring together volunteers and sustainable development leaders to learn about their international projects, while also enjoying cocktails, food from around the world, a live salsa band, hookah lounge, and dancing till late. Two ticket levels allows for anyone to attend this event on Saturday, June 1st, at The Colony, 7575 North Richmond Avenue in St. John's. The event starts at 5:30. More information may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of the Creative Music Guild's second annual Improvisation Summit, Friday, May 31st and Saturday, June 1st at Sandbox Studio. 2 days of exciting performances featuring local artists and William Hooker from New York City. Performers include Golden Retriever, Daniel Menchie, Battle Hymns and Gardens, 1939 Ensemble, and more. Also, there will be workshops, panel discussions, dance, as well as film performances presented by Cinema Project and Experimental Film Festival. The Creative Music Guild is a locally based nonprofit dedicated to presenting adventurous music from the worlds of jazz and experimental avant-garde since 1990. For more information, go to creativemusicguild.org or ask at the information table when you attend the Improvisation Summit on May 31st and June 1st at the Sandbox Studio located at 420 Northeast 9th Avenue in Portland.
You're listening to Radio Zine. I'm Ren Green, and today I'm speaking with Michael Faith, the Executive Director of Living Yoga, whose programming mission focuses on people in drug and alcohol recovery programs, jail, or are participating in community transitional services. What brings you here today, Michael?
Well, I'm here today to talk about Living Yoga's annual Yogathon. KBOO is a sponsor of this event, and thank you very much, KBOO. But mostly to let folks know what exactly is the Yogathon and how they can participate in the Yogathon, and past the Yogathon, how they can be a part of the work that Living Yoga is doing here in our community.
Is the Yogathon a local Portland thing?
Yeah, this specific Yogathon, there's many Yogathons, I'm sure, across the country for different causes, but our Yogathon is in connection with Living Yoga, and Living Yoga is a Portland-based organization.
How many yoga studios are participating?
Well, we've had a tremendous amount of community support for this Yogathon, and we have about 22 community sponsors. Many of them are yoga studios, but in addition to that, we have had many other studios participate by offering things like donation classes and class cards as prizes for our raffles and incentives. So all in all, we've had a tremendous amount of community support outside of just traditional sponsorships.
The Yogathon started on April 13th, so it's been going for a little
over a month. It's a long event.
How do people participate?
It's a six-week long event. And people sign up online. We have a web-based platform that allows people to create their own individual fundraising program. And essentially how it is or how it works is that you as an individual sign up on that fundraising page and you commit to your own personal practice over the course of 6 weeks. So you say, hey, I as Michael, I'm going to commit to taking 30 classes over the next 6 weeks, really deepen my own practice. And then in addition to that, raise money for Living Yoga so that Living Yoga can continue its work of offering classes in prisons and alcohol and drug treatment centers.
And how many people are participating in the fundraising so far?
We just got up to 104 people who are participating as fundraisers. And in addition to the fundraisers, we've had close to 60 donation classes that different studios across town have been offering in support of the Yogathon as well.
So tell me about your mission. You work on behalf of people who are at risk for a variety of reasons, addicts, those who are incarcerated. Why these people? Why yoga? Why them?
Our mission is to bring yoga into prisons and alcohol and drug treatment centers. And it's primarily to make sure that people who would otherwise not have access to the practice receive the multitude of benefits. There's a growing body of research that shows that yoga works for relapse prevention and also reduces recidivism rates. But beyond that, when we take a look at who is in prisons and who is in treatment for addictions, we have to remember that at some point they are going to reenter our community. And so from our perspective, we want to make sure that people reenter into our community with the greatest amount of success so that they can reintegrate and thrive.
What are the mechanisms by which yoga helps people who are in trouble?
So I think that there's a lot of answers that I could give for that. But I think that essentially one of the things that yoga does is it gives people a sense of connection to themselves. And I know that that's kind of like, what does that mean? I always think of it as that yoga brings people back to their sense of goodness. So I always say that yoga reveals people's essential goodness and supports them in living from a place of greatness. And I think that part of that is the mindfulness component of yoga. One of our teachers frequently says, when you bring awareness to your breath, you make better choices. And so I think that one of the things that yoga does really well, it helps with emotional regulation, it helps with impulse control. And why it does that is that it gives you the skills to kind of interrupt automatic pilot mode, that way of operating in the world in which we're just kind of like stuck in our patterns and our habits. Yoga gives you that pause, that break, and allows you time to like think through, is this really how I want to be operating in the world?
I've read that yoga helps develop empathy and that empathy contributes to reduction of self-harmful behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
How does improving empathy get people on a straighter path?
I can share a story with you. One of our students who is now a teacher for us, his name is Troy, and he was at Columbia River Correctional Institution. And what he had to say about that was yoga really provided for him this opportunity to experience self-compassion, right? And from that place of experience, self-compassion, realizing a broader connection to all beings everywhere. So in yoga philosophy, there is this belief that we all are one, and that to create harm to oneself or to create harm to anyone, there's no way of operating in the world that doesn't impact everything else, right? And so through this practice of mindfulness, of yoga, you experience that at deeper and deeper levels. And